Well, thank you so much for having me. I would rather be with you in person. I've traveled to Australia on several occasions, and I love it there. I had to make do with the movie last weekend, but if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. I appreciate the opportunity to work with Vito over the course of the past several months when he's putting this my part of this volume together, and certainly appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I also am going to try to be brief, both because I'm on this screen, and but also to leave opportunity discussion, which I think is really what this is all about. The paper that I put in the volume is one that focuses on what I think is kind of a misapprehensions about what has happened in the United States and the implications of those misapprehensions for what people are thinking about around the world. And as I say in the outset of the paper, of my paper, at the end of the day, this is telecommunications regulation is stunningly complex in detail, and anybody who's gotten their hands dirty in it knows that once you get past the acronyms, you've only gotten started. But the policy decisions at a different level are pretty straightforward. The ultimate policy decision that most governments are dealing with and that we're dealing with in terms of where to go with next generation networks is the simple one of deciding whether or not we think this marketplace is a natural monopoly, in which case we should regulate it and try to bring competition in at whatever level we think the natural monopoly is. If, on the other hand, we believe that the entire business, including the last mile, can be a competitive business, then we need to be careful about the disincentive effects that regulation can have in terms of discouraging investment and discouraging true infrastructure-based competition. Now, the U.S. model, I think, has been widely disparaged. Certainly, it's widely disparaged by people here in the United States, who would have liked to have seen it go a different direction. But my contention is that the U.S. model has turned out to work extremely well and has proven a couple of important propositions, and most importantly, the proposition that we're not dealing with a natural monopoly here in most places. And because of that, we ought to capture the benefits of that infrastructure competition can bring. Now, I do want to say that some people have said we do not have a broadband policy in the United States. That's also a point of contention over here. But the fact is we do have a broadband policy. Pieces of that policy are working, and in particular the piece that has led to infrastructure competition, which is almost universal here. The part of it that's not working is the part that I think you all are wrestling with in particular in Australia today, and that is what do you do about the geographic areas which remain a natural monopoly? And unquestionably, there are geographic areas which are, and for the foreseeable future, are likely to be a natural monopoly, at least as far as fast wireline-based broadband competition goes. So on that front, I don't think the U.S. is a very good model, and I'm not sure there are all that many very good models. But I'll close with some thoughts on that front. But first, let me talk about the piece that I think is working and working extremely well. And I think it's an important lesson for Europe, which I think is going in a different direction. And I think it's an important lesson for Australia, which I fear is going in a different direction. And that is that we have made infrastructure competition work, and in fairly recent history. We passed our Telecommunications Act in 1996, and both the Act and the way it was implemented required a substantial amount of mandatory unbundling. Now, this is in the very early days of the Internet. The main focus in the telecommunications, the telephone part of the industry, was on the unbundling of telephone services, but those unbundling regulations, to the extent there were broadband services being offered by telephone companies, also applied to DSL and retail broadband infrastructures. And those rules were implemented in 1996 and remained in place, as I'll talk about, till 2003. The other infrastructure that we've had, and we might get into this in questions, I won't talk too much about it now, but the infrastructure that we've had in the U.S., which is virtually ubiquitous, is the cable infrastructure. About 85%, 80 to 90% of U.S. homes are passed by our now digitally upgraded cable infrastructure. And there was a question in the late 1990s about whether or not our cable infrastructure should be unbundled. There were proposals for what was called open access requirements on cable infrastructure in the late 1990s, and those came to a head in 1999 under our Democratic chairman of the FCC, Bill Kennard. And Kennard was faced with the need to approve or deny the merger of TCI, our largest cable company, and AT&T, our largest long-distance telephone company. And many people at the time, internet service providers in particular, argued that we needed to have essentially mandatory unbundling on cable. Kennard disagreed with that and ultimately said, and in a compelling speech in 1999, he said he had previously served as general counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, and he said, you know, I've watched us put in place all of these unbundling regulations for telephone companies, and it is very easy to say that we should adopt a principle of open access, anybody can use the wires, but it's something else to write the rules and put them in place and enforce them and actually try to make that system work. And I've seen what he called the morass of telephone regulation, and before we, what he said, dump that entire morass of telephone regulation on the cable companies, we ought to at least give competition a chance and see whether or not we really need to do that. So at that point in 1999, there were some further court decisions, but that was the point at which the U.S. decided we're not going to put mandatory unbundling requirements on our cable infrastructure. And what you saw was a fairly immediate and rapid increase in investment by the cable companies, which only in a few, very few areas were offering cable modem service at that time. They began investing very rapidly in upgrading their networks to digital and offering what is now virtually ubiquitous cable modem service and now cable telephony service. The history with respect to the telephone company is a little different. They were subjected to all these unbundling regulations. But ultimately, thanks in part to the U.S. courts, which found that the FCC had overstepped in putting those rules in place, in 2003, series of decisions in 2003, 4, and 5, the FCC ultimately removed those unbundling requirements as they applied to fiber and then ultimately as they applied to DSL. And what we saw from that point was the same effect, a very rapid increase in investment by the telephone companies in broadband infrastructure, up about 40% over the levels in 2003, and the nearly ubiquitous availability of DSL, and now very substantial investments being made in fiber. We have about 15 to 18 million homes in the U.S. that are now passed by fiber, about 3 million fiber subscribers in the U.S., and those numbers are growing very rapidly. So we've seen fiber build out. Well, those two decisions, ultimately, the decision made in the U.S. with respect to those two platforms, and of course we've never really seriously considered unbundling of wireless networks. We've essentially had a deregulatory framework for wireless. Those decisions taken together have led us to have nearly ubiquitous infrastructure-based competition. About 80% of the homes in the U.S. have availability of broadband services from at least three providers, a telephone company, a cable company, and at least one wireless broadband provider. In addition, in a number of big U.S. cities, we have cable overbuilders, so we actually have a fourth wireless, a third wireline provider, and at least four total broadband providers. And I want to point out, I won't spend too much time focusing on the Australian experience, and the theory. We'll get into that in questions. But I do want to say that the markets where we have all of this competition are markets that are not dissimilar from Brisbane or Melbourne or Sydney. The market for cable services, for example, is not a national market. We have cable systems which occupy only one city and are managed as individual systems. And so the same kind of economies of scale and scope that one would find in Brisbane or Melbourne or Sydney are present in places like Tampa or Detroit or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., where we have cable overbuilders. And I'd also point out that in addition to all of that, we also have two nationwide providers of satellite television. So the cable companies are competing not just with not just with overbuilders and increasingly with the fiber-based telephone companies, Verizon Fios system. They're also competing with two satellite, nationwide satellite networks, which have about 35% to 40% of the market for pay TV services in the U.S. Now, what has been the upshot of this approach? First of all, investment in the U.S. has been very substantial. I mentioned that investment is up about 40%. But to put in context telecommunications investment in the U.S., U.S. telecommunications companies in 2007 invested about $70 billion in infrastructure. By contrast, the United States federal government invested about $57 billion, $13 billion less, in all forms of transportation, all roads, all bridges, all airports, all railroads. Taken together, the federal investment in infrastructure was about $57 billion compared to $70 billion in basically the broadband infrastructure in private investment being put in by the telephone companies. So we've had very substantial investment. We've also had rapid drops in prices. So as we look at overall telecommunications prices in the United States, since in the past 5 years have dropped by about 6%. That's an actual decline in prices. Compared to overall prices in the United States, which are up by about 17%. So a difference of about 23% between what's happened with telecommunications prices and what's happened with prices overall. You know, we hear about the OECD statistics. I'm not going to very briefly treat those in my paper. I'd urge everybody to look at some of the sources cited in my paper before giving very much credence to these very widely cited statistics that we are 15th in the world, or Australia, I think at one point, was 19th in the world in broadband penetration. There's a lot going on in those statistics. Some of it has to do with household size, some of it has to do with age, some of it has to do with the counting of wireless and business connections. I don't think it's a meaningless statistic, but I don't think it is the ultimate statistic that we ought to be judging our policy performance by. Certainly in the United States, we have broadband penetration increasing at very, very rapid rates, upwards of 60% today in broadband penetration. Three last points. The first is there is a new phenomenon I do not spend a whole lot of time talking about in my paper, in part because the data is just now coming out. But the new phenomenon is that we are now seeing wireless data substitution beginning to march up the same curve that we have seen wireless voice substitution march up already. So in the United States today, about 20% of all voice telephone customers are using wireless only. They're cord cutters and they've substituted away from wireline entirely. What we are now seeing is wireless data substitution beginning to march up that same path. And two new studies out, one from Nielsen. I know Nielsen also does research in Australia, in the United States, reporting that over 40% of people with wireless data cards use their wireless data cards as their main broadband connection at home. And we don't even have NextG here, so it's probably higher in Australia because we're not looking at 14.4 megabit download speeds on our third generation wireless networks, and that an even larger percentage of them are considering giving up their landline broadband connections in favor of just a wireless connection. So this is relevant to this debate about how many pipes. Do we need two pipes or three pipes, and are just telephone companies and cable companies a duopoly, and what does that mean? That debate if nothing else, has become obsolete, because as we see wireless substitution taking place in the data space, we have now not one pipe or two pipe, and people talk about the wireless pipe as a third pipe. The wireless pipe is not a third pipe. The wireless pipe is two or three or four individual competitors. So we're not talking about the first pipe, the second pipe, and then wireless being the third pipe. We're talking about the first pipe, the second pipe, and wireless being the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth pipes. And once you get in an industry with declining costs like we're talking about in the telecom industry, if you've got four, five, or six competitors, that is a extremely unconcentrated industry where you can expect competition to prevail. Very briefly, what not to do in the rural space, what not to do in terms of subsidizing rural development. We've, I think, made all the mistakes here. We're spending about $7 billion a year, with a B per year, not one time, subsidizing local telephone service in rural areas in the U.S. We've gone about doing that very badly for reasons that I won't go into here, except to say that we have policies which are neither competitively neutral nor technologically neutral. Our current policies, we have picked a technology and we have picked a particular type of firm that we're going to subsidize. And what that means is that just because the fact that one chooses to subsidize something does not mean that one needs to forego all of the benefits of competition, innovation, and choice. The way we've gone about it, we have, for practical purposes, foregone the benefits of competition, innovation, and choice. And, you know, as you all think about what to do with the national broadband build and so forth, you know, those would be principles that that I would urge you to think about. I also worry, and I follow it a little bit, that the way the NBN is playing out is it almost seems to be an excuse for very substantial re-regulation of the telecom business. I'll give you $4.7 billion if you will agree to be very heavily regulated, for example, to engage in structural separation. And that's the opposite of the direction we ought to go in. My very last point is this, and then I'm done, and that is, with all due respect to Dr. Porter, and I've read his paper and agree with almost everything in it, I will just say briefly that I think as a competition economist, I don't quite see the benefit of spinning off a cable network here, the HFC plant, in either case. What the ACCC has just issued a decision which is highly skeptical of whether or not two wireline broadband competitors are economically viable or efficient. Passing the 2 million or so homes that the Optus and Telstra networks currently pass. The effect of forcing, let's say, Telstra to spin off its cable network would be to raise the number of competitors from 2 to 3 in the wireline space. Now, if two competitors are not viable, and Optus's lack of investment in its HFC plant certainly indicates it doesn't seem to think its HFC network is very viable, it's difficult to see how a forcing of a third wireline competitor would do anything but make it less viable. What we need to be doing there is I think, first of all, asking the question, you know, why is Optus not as inclined as it might be to upgrade that network? In the United States and elsewhere around the world, we have a rapid progression now to what's called the DOCSIS 3 standard for cable systems. DOCSIS 3 is offering 160 megabits of downstream bandwidth and tremendous functionality and opportunities for product differentiation. So I think the question, you know, that needs to be asked is why are we in Australia in Optus footprint dealing with a 1996 infrastructure, literally still using 1996 equipment, when the opportunity for technological progress is evident, and the costs of that kind of upgrade are literally imploding by 30 to 50% a year. So, as I say, I agree with almost everything Dr. Porter said. That's one solution that doesn't feel like a solution to me. A better question, I think, would be to ask the question, why not? What is wrong with the cable telco competition that we should have today? Why are we not seeing that competition taking place? And until we answer that question, forcing a spinoff and having a third competitor in the market probably is a risk not worth taking. So with that, I'll stop, and again, I appreciate the opportunity to be with you.